Simon & Schuster Audio presents It Starts With Us, a novel by Colleen Hoover. Read by Olivia Song and Colin Donnell.
This book is for the brave and bold Maria Blaylock.
Chapter 1. Atlas. The way asshole is misspelled in red spray paint across the back door of Bibbs makes me think of my mother. She would always insert a brief pause between syllables, making it sound like two separate words. I wanted to laugh every time I heard it, but it was hard to find the humor in it as a child when I was always the recipient of the hurled insult. Ass-hole, Darren mutters. Had to be a kid. Most adults know how to spell that word. You'd be surprised. I touch the paint, but it doesn't stick to my fingers. Whoever did this must have done it right after we closed last night. Do you think the misspelling was intentional? He asks. Are they suggesting you're so much of an asshole that you are a whole entire ass? Why do you assume they were targeting me? They could have been targeting you or Brad. It's your restaurant. Darren takes off his jacket and uses it to pry a large shard of exposed broken glass out of the window. Maybe it was a disgruntled employee. Do I have disgruntled employees? I can't think of a single person on payroll who would do something like this. The last person I had had quit was 5 months ago, and she left on good terms after getting a college degree. There was that guy who did the dishes before you hired Brad. What was his name? He was named after some kind of mineral or something. It was super weird. Quartz, I say. It was a nickname. I haven't thought about that guy in so long. I doubt he's holding a grudge against me after all this time. I fired him right after we opened because I found out he wasn't washing the dishes unless he could actually see food on them. Glasses, plates, silverware. Anything that came back to the kitchen from a table looking fairly clean, he'd just put it straight on the drying rack. If I wouldn't have fired him, he would have gotten us shut down by the health department. You should call the police, Darren says. We'll have to file a report for insurance. Before I object, Brad appears at the back door, his shoes crunching the broken glass beneath his feet. Brad has been inside taking inventory in order to see if anything was stolen. He scratches the stubble on his jaw. They took the croutons. There's a confused pause.
Did you say croutons? Darren asks.
Yeah. They took the whole thing of croutons that were prepared last night. Nothing else seems to be missing, though. That wasn't at all what I was expecting him to say. If someone broke into a restaurant and didn't take appliances or anything else of value, they probably broke in because they were hungry. I know that kind of desperation firsthand. I'm not reporting this. Darren turns to me. Why not? They might catch whoever did it. That's the point. I grab an empty box out of the dumpster and start picking up shards of glass. I broke into a restaurant once, stole a turkey sandwich. Brad and Darren are both staring at me now.
Were you drunk? Darren asks.
No. I was hungry. I don't want anyone arrested for stealing croutons.
Okay, but maybe food was only the beginning.
What if they come back for appliances next time? Darren says. Is the security camera still broken? He's been on me to get that repaired for months now. I've been busy. Darren takes the box of glass from me and starts to pick up the remaining pieces.
You should go work on that before they come back. Heck, they might even try to hit up Corrigan's tonight since Bibbs was such an easy target.
Corrigan's has working security, and I doubt whoever it was will vandalize my new restaurant. It was a matter of convenience, not a targeted break-in.
You hope, Darren says.
I open my mouth to respond, but I'm interrupted by an incoming text message. I don't think I've ever reached for my phone faster. When I see the text isn't from Lily, I deflate a little. I ran into her this morning while I was running errands. It was the first time we've seen each other in a year and a half, but she was late for work and I had just received the text from Darren informing me we had a break-in.
We parted somewhat awkwardly on the promise that she would text me once she got to work. It's been an hour and a half since then, and I still haven't heard from her. An hour and a half is nothing, but I can't ignore the nagging in my chest that's trying to convince me she's having doubts about everything that was said between us in that five-minute exchange on the sidewalk. I'm definitely not having doubts about what I said. I might have gotten caught up in the moment in seeing how happy she looked and finding out she's no longer married. But I meant every word I said to her. I'm ready for this. More than ready. I pull up her contact info in my phone. I've wanted to text her so many times over the last year and a half, but the last time I spoke to her, I left the ball in her court. She had so much going on, I didn't want to complicate her life even more. She's single now, though, and she made it sound like she was finally ready to give whatever could be between us a chance. However, she's had an hour and a half to think about our conversation, and an hour and a half is plenty of time to form regrets. Every minute that passes without a text is going to feel like a whole damn day. She's still listed as Lily Kincaid in my phone, so I edit her contact info and change her last name back to Bloom. I feel Darren hovering, looking over my shoulder at my phone screen. Is that our Lily? Brad perks up. He's texting Lily? Our Lily? I ask, confused. You guys met her once. Is she still married? Darren asks. I shake my head. Good for her, he says. She was pregnant, right? What did she end up having, a boy or a girl? I don't want to discuss Lily because there's nothing to discuss yet. I don't want to make it more than what it might be. A girl. And that's the last question I'm answering. I focus on Brad. Theo coming in today? It's Thursday. He'll be here. I head inside the restaurant. If I'm going to discuss Lily with anyone, it'll be Theo.
Chapter 2. Lily. My hands are still shaking, even though it's been almost 2 hours since I ran into Atlas. I can't tell if I'm shaking because I'm flustered or because I've been too busy to eat since I walked in the door. I've barely had 5 seconds of peace to process what happened this morning, much less eat the breakfast I brought with me. Did that actually just happen? Did I really ask Atlas a series of questions so awkward I'll be mortified well into next year? He didn't seem awkward, though. He seemed very happy to see me, and then when he hugged me, it felt like a part of me that had been dormant suddenly sprang to life. But this is the first moment I've had to even take a bathroom break, and after looking at myself in the mirror just now, I kind of want to cry. I'm splotchy, I have carrots smeared across my shirt, my nail polish has been chipped since, like, January. Not that Atlas expects or wants perfection. It's just that I've imagined running into him so many times, but not one of those fantasies starred me bumping into him in the middle of a hectic morning, half an hour after being the target of an 11-month-old with a handful of baby food. He looked so good. He smelled so good. I probably smell like breast milk. I'm so rattled by what our chance encounter might mean, it took me twice as long to organize everything for the delivery driver this morning. I haven't even checked our website for new orders today. I give myself one last look in the mirror, but all I see is an exhausted, overworked single mom. I make my way out of the bathroom and back to the register. I pull an order from the printer and begin making out the card. My mind has never been more in need of a distraction, so I'm glad it's been a busy morning. The order is for a bouquet of roses for someone named Greta from someone named Jonathan. The message reads, "I'm sorry about last night. Forgive me." I groan. Apology flowers are my least favorite kind of bouquets to assemble. I always end up obsessing over what they're apologizing for. Did he miss their date? Did he come home late? Did they fight? Did he hit her? Sometimes I want to write the number for the local domestic violence shelter on the cards, but I have to remind myself that not every apology is attached to something as awful as the things that were attached to the apologies I used to receive. Maybe Jonathan is Greta's friend and he's trying to cheer her up. Maybe he's her husband and he took a prank a little too far. Whatever the reason for the flowers, I hope they mean something good. I tuck the card into the envelope and stick it into the bouquet of roses. I set them on the delivery shelf and am pulling up the next order when I receive a text. I lunge for my phone as if the text is about to self-destruct, and I only have 3 seconds to read it. I shrink when I look at the screen. It's not from Atlas, but rather from Ryle.
Can she eat French fries?
I shoot a quick response. Soft ones. I drop my phone onto the counter with a thud. I don't like for her to have French fries too often, but Ryle only has her 1 to 2 days a week, so I try to make sure she gets more nutritious foods when she's with me. It was nice not thinking about Ryle for a few minutes, but his text has reminded me that he exists. And as long as he exists, I fear that any type of relationship, or even a friendship between me and Atlas, can't exist. How will Ryle take it if I start seeing Atlas? How would he act if they ever had to be around each other? Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. I stare at my phone, wondering what I should say to Atlas. I told him I would text him after I opened the store, but customers were waiting before I even unlocked the door. And now that Ryle has texted, I've gone and remembered Ryle exists in this scenario too, which makes me hesitant to text Atlas at all. The front door opens, and my employee, Lucy, finally walks in. She always seems so put together, even when I can tell she's in a bad mood. "Good morning, Lucy." She flicks hair out of her eyes and sets her purse on the counter with a sigh. "Is it?" Lucy isn't at her friendliest in the morning. It's why my other employees, Serena or I, usually work the register until at least 11, while Lucy puts arrangements together in the back. She is much better with customers after a cup or five of coffee. "I just found out our place cards never arrived because they were discontinued, and it's too late to order more. The wedding is in less than a month." So much has gone wrong leading up to this wedding. I have half a mind to tell her not to go through with it. But I'm not superstitious. Hopefully, she isn't either. "Homemade place cards are in style," I offer. Lucy rolls her eyes. "I hate crafting," she mutters. "I don't even want a wedding now. It feels like we've been planning it for longer than we even dated." "That's accurate. Maybe we'll just call it off and go to Vegas. You eloped, right? Do you regret it?" I don't know which part of all that to address first. "How can you hate crafting? You work at a flower shop. And I'm divorced. Of course I regret eloping." I hand her a small stack of orders I haven't gotten to yet. "But it was fun," I admit. Lucy goes to the back and starts on the rest of the orders, and I go back to thinking about Atlas and Ryle and Armageddon, which is what the two of them in my brain at the same time feels like. I have no idea how this is expected to work. When Atlas and I ran into each other, it was as if everything else faded away, including Ryle. But now, Ryle is beginning to seep back into my thoughts. Not in the way thoughts of Ryle used to occupy my mind, but more in a way that feels like a roadblock. My love life has finally been on a straight path with no bumps or curves, basically because it's been non-existent for well over a year and a half. But now it feels like there's nothing but rough terrain and obstacles and cliffs ahead. Is it worth it? Of course, Atlas is worth it. But are we worth it? Is us potentially becoming a thing worth the stress it would inevitably bring to all the other areas of my life? I haven't felt this conflicted in so long. Part of me wants to call Elisa and tell her about seeing Atlas, but I can't. She knows how Ryle still feels about me. She knows how he'd feel if I brought Atlas into the picture. I can't talk to my mother because she's my mother. As close as we've become lately, I'd still never freely discuss my dating life with her. There's really only one woman I feel comfortable talking to about Atlas. "Lucy?" She appears from the back, pulling an earbud out of her ear.
"Did you need me?"
"Can you cover me for a while? I need to go run an errand. I'll be back in an hour." She makes her way behind the counter, and I grab my purse. I don't get a lot of alone time now that I have Emerson, so I occasionally steal an hour here and there during the work week when I have someone to back up my absence at the shop.
Sometimes I like to sit in my thoughts, and it's impossible to do that in the presence of a child, because even when she's asleep, I'm in mom mode. And with the constant flow of traffic at work, it's rare that I can find a stretch of peace without being interrupted. I've found that being alone in my car with my music on and occasionally a slice of dessert from the Cheesecake Factory is sometimes all it takes to sort through the knots in my brain. Once I'm parked with a clear view of Boston Harbor, I lean my seat back and grab the notepad and pen I brought with me. I don't know if this will help as much as dessert sometimes does, but I need to release my thoughts in the same way I've done in the past. This method has helped before when I need things to fall neatly into place. Although this time, I'm just hoping it helps things not to fall completely apart. Dear Ellen, guess who's back? Me. And Alice. Both of us. I ran into him on my way to meet Ryle with Emmy this morning. It was so good to see him. But as reaffirming as it was to see him and to know where we both stand at this point in our lives, it ended a bit awkwardly. He was having a minor emergency with his restaurant and was in a hurry. I was late opening the store. We parted on the promise that I would text him. I want to text him. I do, especially because seeing him reminded me of how much I miss the feeling I get when I'm around him. I didn't realize how lonely I'd been feeling until those few minutes with him this morning. But since Ryle and I divorced, oh, wait. Wow, I haven't told you about the divorce. It's been way too long since I've written to you. Let me back up. I decided my separation from Ryle should be permanent after giving birth to Emmy. I asked him for a divorce right after she was born. I wasn't attempting to be cruel in my timing. I just didn't know which choice I was going to make until I held her in my arms and knew with every fiber of my being that I would do whatever it took to break the cycle of abuse. Yes, asking for a divorce hurt. Yes, I was heartbroken. But no, I don't regret it. My choice helped me realize that sometimes the hardest decisions a person can make will most likely lead to the best outcomes. I can't lie and say I don't miss him, because I do. I miss what we sometimes were. I miss the family we could have been for Emerson. But I know I made the right decision, even though I sometimes get overwhelmed by the weight of it. It's difficult because I still have to interact with Ryle. He still possesses all the good qualities I fell in love with, and now that I'm no longer in a relationship with him, it's rare I see the negative side that ultimately ended our marriage. I think that has to do with the fact that he's on his best behavior. He had to be agreeable and not put up too much of a fight because he knew I could have reported him for all the incidents of domestic violence I experienced at his hands. He could have lost a lot more than his wife. So when it came to the custody arrangement, things were more amiable than I expected them to be. That may have been more because I put up less of a fight than he did. My lawyer was very straightforward when I said I wanted sole custody. Unless I was willing to drag the dirtiest parts of our rock bottom into a courtroom, there wasn't much I could do to prevent Ryle from getting visits with Emerson. And even if I were to bring up the domestic violence, my lawyer said it's very rare that a willing, successful father without a record who provides financial support would have any sort of rights removed. I was looking at two options. I could choose to press charges and drag this through the courts, only to be met with a very possible joint custody arrangement, or I could attempt to work an agreement out with Ryle that would satisfy us both while preserving our co-parenting relationship. I guess you could say we came to a compromise, even though there isn't an agreement in the world that would make me feel comfortable with sending my daughter off with someone I know possesses a temper. But all I can do is choose the lesser of two evils when it comes to custody, and hope that Emmy never sees that side of him. I want Emmy to bond with her father. I've never wanted to keep her from him. I just want to ensure she's safe, which is why I begged Ryle to agree to day visits for the first couple of years. I never told him outright it's because I don't know that I fully trust him with her. I think I might have blamed it on my breastfeeding situation and the fact that he's on call all the time. But deep down, I'm sure he knows why I've never wanted her to stay with him overnight. The past abuse is something we don't talk about. We talk about Emmy. We talk about work. We plaster on smiles when we're in the presence of our daughter. Sometimes it feels forced and fake, at least on my end, but it's better than what this could have been had I taken him to court and lost. I'll fake a smile until she's 18 if it means I don't have to share custody and potentially expose my daughter to the worst parts of her father on a more regular basis. It's been working out okay so far, if you don't count the occasional gaslighting and unwanted flirtation from him. As clear as I've made my feelings during this divorce, he still has hope for us. He says things sometimes that indicate he hasn't fully let go of the idea of us. I fear that a huge part of Ryle's cooperation rests on the notion that he'll eventually win me back if he's good enough, for long enough. He has it in his head that I'll soften over time. But life isn't going to happen his way, Ellen. I'm ultimately going to move on, and if I'm being honest, I hope I end up moving on in Atlas's direction. It's too soon to know if that's a possibility, but I know for a fact I'll never move back in Ryle's direction, no matter how much time passes. It's been almost a year since I asked Ryle for the divorce, but it's been almost 19 months since the fight that ultimately caused our separation. Which means I've been single for over a year and a half. A year and a half of separation between potential relationships seems like plenty of time, and maybe it would be if it were anyone other than Atlas. But how can I possibly make this work? What if I text Atlas and he invites me to lunch, and then lunch goes wonderful, which I'm sure it would, and lunch leads to dinner? And dinner leads to us falling right back into step with where we left off when we were younger. And then we're both happy and we fall back in love and he becomes a permanent part of my life. I know it sounds like I'm getting ahead of myself, but it's Atlas we're talking about here. Unless he had a personality transplant, I think you and I both know how easy Atlas is for me to love, Ellen. That's why I'm so hesitant, because I'm scared it will work out. And if it works out, how will Ryle feel about my new relationship? Emerson is almost a year old, and we've gone this whole year without too much drama. But I know that's because we've found a good flow that nothing has interrupted. So why does it feel like any mention of Atlas will cause a tsunami? Not that Ryle deserves the concern I'm currently feeling over this situation, but he has the potential to make my dating life a living hell. Why does Ryle still occupy an entire wall in my many layers of thoughts? That's what it feels like, as if these wonderful things happen. But as they start to sink in, they eventually reach a part of me that is still making decisions based on Ryle and his potential reactions. His reactions are what I fear the most. I want to hope that he wouldn't be jealous, but he will be. If I start dating Atlas, he'll make it difficult for everyone. Even though I know divorce was the right choice, there are still consequences to that choice. And one of those consequences is that Ryle will always look at Atlas like he's the thing that broke up our marriage. Ryle is the father of my daughter. No matter what man comes and goes in my life from this point forward, Ryle is the one constant that I'll always have to appease if I want the most peaceful experience for my daughter. And if Atlas Corrigan is back in my life, Ryle will never be appeased. I wish you could tell me what decision to make. Do I sacrifice what I know will make me happy for the sake of avoiding the inevitable disruption Atlas's presence would cause? Or will I always have an Atlas-shaped hole in my heart unless I allow him to fill it? He's expecting me to text him, but I think I need more time to process this. I don't even know what to say to him. I don't know what to do. I'll let you know if I figure it out. Lily.
Chapter 3. Atlas.
We finally reached the shore, Theo says. You actually said that to her? Out loud? I shift uncomfortably on the couch. We bonded over Finding Nemo when we were younger. You quoted a cartoon. Theo's head roll is dramatic. And it didn't work. It's been over 8 hours since you ran into her, and she still hasn't texted you. Maybe she got busy. Or maybe you came on too strong, Theo says, leaning forward. He clasps his hands between his knees and refocuses. Okay, so what happened after you said all the cheesy lines?
He's brutal. Nothing. We both had to get to work. I asked if she still had my number, and she said she had it memorized, and then we said good...
Hold up, Theo interrupts. She has your number memorized?
Apparently so.
Okay. He looks hopeful. This means something. No one memorizes numbers anymore.
I was thinking the same thing, but I also wondered if she memorized my number for other reasons. Back when I wrote it down and put it in her phone case, it was for an emergency. Maybe part of her feared the day she'd need it, so she memorized it for reasons that had nothing to do with me. So what do I do? Text her, call her, wait until she reaches out to me?
It's been 8 hours, Atlas. Calm down.
His advice has given me whiplash. 2 minutes ago, you acted like 8 hours without a text was too long. Now you're telling me to calm down? Theo shrugs and kicks my desk to make his chair spin.
I'm 12. I don't even have a phone yet, and yet you want my opinion on texting etiquette?
It surprises me that he doesn't have a phone yet. Brad doesn't seem like he would be a strict father. Why don't you have a phone?
Dad says I can have one when I turn 13.
2 more months, he says wistfully. Theo has been coming to the restaurant a couple days a week after school since Brad's promotion 6 months ago. Theo told me he wanted to be a therapist when he grows up, so I let him practice on me. At first, the talks we would have were intended for his benefit, but lately, I feel like I'm the one benefiting. Brad peeks his head into my office in search of his son. Let's go. Atlas has work to do. He motions for Theo to stand up, but Theo just keeps spinning in my desk chair.
Atlas is the one who called me in here. He needed advice.
I'll never understand whatever this is, Brad says, pointing between me and Theo. What advice do you get from my son? How to avoid your chores and win at Minecraft? Theo stands up and stretches his arms over his head.
Girls, actually, and winning isn't the point of Minecraft, Dad. It's more of a sandbox game.
Theo looks over his shoulder at me as he's leaving my office.
Just text her. He says that like it's the obvious solution.
Maybe it is. Brad yanks him away from the door. I settle back into my desk chair and stare at my blank phone screen. Maybe she memorized the wrong number. I open her contact and hesitate. Theo could be right. I could have come on too strong this morning. We didn't say much when we ran into each other, but what we did say had meaning and intent. Maybe that scared her.
Or
maybe I'm right and she memorized the wrong number. My fingers hover over my phone's keyboard. I want to text her, but I don't want to pressure her. However, she and I both know our lives would have turned out so different if I hadn't made so many missteps with her in the past. I spent years making excuses for why my life wasn't good enough for her to be a part of it. But Lily always fit. She was a perfect fit. I refuse to let her walk away this time without a little more effort on my part. I'll start with making sure she has my correct number. It was good seeing you today, Lily. I wait to see if she's going to text me back. When I see the 3 dots pop up, I hold my breath in anticipation. You too. I stare at her response for way too long, hoping it'll be accompanied by another text, but it isn't. That's all I'm getting. It's only 2 words, but I can read between the lines. I sigh in defeat and drop my phone onto my desk.
Chapter 4. Lily. Mine and Ryle's situation has been an unconventional one since Emerson was born. I don't think many couples file divorce papers at the same time they sign their newborn's birth certificate. As much as I was disappointed in Ryle for being the thing that forced me to have to make the decision to end our marriage, I didn't want to prevent him from bonding with our daughter. I cooperate with him as much as I can since his schedule is so hectic. I sometimes even take her to his work to visit him on his lunch break. He's also had a key to my place since before Emerson was born. I only gave it to him because I lived alone and was afraid I'd go into labor and he'd need access to the apartment. But he never gave the key back after her birth, even though I've been meaning to ask him for it. He sometimes uses it on the rare occasions he has a late surgery and has extra time to spend with Emmy in the mornings after I head to work. That's why I haven't asked for it back. But lately, he's been using the key to bring Emmy home. He texted me just before I closed the shop earlier and told me Emmy was tired, so he was taking her to my place to put her to bed. The frequency he's been using the key lately is making me wonder if Emmy is the only one he's trying to spend more time with. My front door is unlocked when I finally make it to my apartment. Ryle is in the kitchen. He glances up at me when he hears the front door shut.
I grab dinner,
he says, holding up a bag from my favorite Thai place.
You haven't eaten, have you?
I don't like this. He's been making himself more and more comfortable here. But I'm emotionally drained from the day already, so I shake my head and decide to confront the issue at a different time. I haven't. Thank you. I set my purse on the table and pass the kitchen, heading for Emmy's room.
I just laid her down, he warns.
I pause right outside her door and press my ear to it. It's quiet, so I back away from the door and head into the kitchen without waking her. I feel awful about my short response to Atlas earlier, but this interaction with Ryle is confirming all my concerns. How am I supposed to start something with someone new when my ex still brings me dinner and has a key to my apartment? I need to set firm boundaries with Ryle before I can even begin to entertain the idea of Atlas. Ryle chooses a bottle of red wine from my tabletop wine rack.
Mind if I open this?
I shrug as I spoon pad thai onto my plate. Go ahead, but I don't want any. Ryle puts the bottle back and opts for a glass of tea. I grab a water out of the fridge, and we both take a seat at the table. How was she today? I ask him.
A little cranky, but I had a lot of errands to run. I think she just got tired of going in and out of the car seat.
She was better when we went over to Elisa's. When's your next day off? I ask him.
Not sure. I'll let you know.
He reaches forward and uses his thumb to wipe something off my cheek. I flinch a little, but he doesn't notice. Or maybe he pretends not to. I'm not sure if he realizes the reaction I have any time his hand comes near me is a negative one. Knowing Ryle, he probably thinks I flinched because I felt a spark. After Emmy was born, there were moments here and there when I would feel a spark between us. He'd do or say something sweet, or he'd be holding Emmy while he sang to her, and I would feel that familiar desire for him bubbling up inside of me. But I somehow found it within me to pull myself out of the moment every time. It only takes one bad memory to immediately dull any fleeting feelings I have in his presence. It's been a long, bumpy road, but those feelings are finally non-existent. I attribute that to the list I wrote of all the reasons why I chose to divorce him. Sometimes, after he leaves, I go to my bedroom and read it to reiterate that this arrangement is the best one for all of us. Well, maybe not this exact arrangement. I'd still like my key returned to me. I'm about to take another bite of noodles when I hear a muffled ping come from my purse across the table. I drop my fork and quickly reach for my phone before Ryle does. Not that he would read my texts, but the last thing I want right now is for him to even try to be polite by handing me my phone. He might see that the text is from Atlas, and I'm not prepared for the storm that would bring. The text isn't from Atlas, though. It's from my mother. She's sending pics of Emmy she took earlier this week. I set the phone down and pick up my fork, but Ryle is staring at me. It was my mother, I say. I don't know why I even say that. I don't owe him an explanation, but I don't like the way he's staring at me.
Who were you hoping it would be? You practically lunged across the table for your phone.
No one. I take a drink. He's still staring. I have no idea how well Ryle can read me, but it looks like he knows I'm lying. He spins his fork in his noodles and looks down at his plate with a hardened jaw.
Are you seeing someone?
There's an edge to his voice now. Not that it's any of your business, but no.
Not saying it is my business. Just having a casual conversation.
I don't respond to that because it's a lie. Any recently divorced husband asking his ex-wife if she's seeing someone is making anything but casual conversation.
I do think we need to have a more serious conversation at some point about dating, he says, before either of us brings other people around Emerson. Maybe lay some ground rules.
I nod. I think we need to lay ground rules for a lot more than just that. His eyes narrow.
Like what?
Your access to my apartment. I swallow. I'd like my key back. Ryle stares stoically before he responds. Then he wipes his mouth and says,
I can't put my daughter to bed.
That's not what I'm saying at all.
You know my schedule is crazy, Lily. I hardly get to see her as it is.
I'm not saying I want you to see her any less. I just want my key back. I value my privacy. Ryle's expression is tight. He's upset with me. I knew he would be, but he's making this into more than it is. It has nothing to do with how much I want him to see Emmy. I just don't want him having easy access to my apartment. I moved out and divorced him for a reason. It's not going to be a huge change, but it's one that needs to happen, or we'll be stuck in this unhealthy routine forever.
I'll just start keeping her overnight then.
He says it with such conviction while eyeing me for a reaction. I know he can feel the discomfort I'm suddenly drowning in. I keep my voice calm. I don't think I'm ready for that. Ryle drops his fork on his plate with a thud.
Maybe we need to modify the custody arrangement.
Those words infuriate me, but I somehow prevent my rage from boiling over. I stand and pick up my plate. Really, Ryle? I ask for the key to my apartment back, and you threaten me with court? We agreed to this arrangement, but he's acting like that was for my benefit rather than his. He knows I could have taken him to court for sole custody after everything he put me through. Hell, I never even had him arrested. He should be grateful I've been as generous as I have. When I get to the kitchen, I set down my plate and grip the edges of the counter, allowing my head to drop between my shoulders. Calm down, Lily. He's just reacting. I hear Ryle sigh regretfully, and then he follows me into the kitchen. He leans against the counter while I rinse my plate.
Can you at least give me a timeline?
His voice is lower when he speaks.
When will I get overnights with her?
I press my hip against the counter and face him. When she can talk.
Why then?
I hate that he even needs me to say this out loud. So she can tell me if something happens, Ryle. When the full meaning of what I've just said sinks in, he chews on his bottom lip with a small nod. I can see the frustration in the veins that rise in his neck. He pulls his keys out of his pocket and removes my apartment key. He tosses it on the counter and walks away. When he grabs his jacket and disappears out the front door, I feel that familiar twinge of guilt creeping into my chest. The guilt is always followed by doubts like, am I being too hard on him? And what if he really has changed? I know the answers to these questions, but sometimes it feels good to read the reminders. I go to my room and pull the list out of my jewelry box. 1. He slapped you because you laughed. 2. He pushed you down a flight of stairs. 3. He bit you. 4. He tried to force himself on you. 5. You had to get stitches because of him. 6. Your husband physically hurt you more than once. It would have happened again and again. 7. You did this for your daughter. I run my finger over the tattoo on my shoulder, feeling the small scars he left there with his teeth. If Ryle did these things to me at the highest points of our relationship, what would he be capable of at the lowest? I fold the list and put it back in my jewelry box for the next time I might need a reminder.
Chapter 5. Atlas. It was definitely targeted, Brad says, staring at the graffiti. Whoever vandalized Bibbs 2 nights ago decided to hit up my newest restaurant last night. Corrigan's has 2 damaged windows, and there's another message spray-painted across the back door. Fuck you, Atlas. They added an S and underlined ass in my name. I catch myself wanting to laugh at the cleverness, but my mood isn't making space for humor this morning. Yesterday, the vandalism barely fazed me. I don't know if it was because I had just run into Lily and was still riding that high, but this morning I woke up stuck on her apparent avoidance of me. Because of that, the damage to my newest restaurant feels like it's cutting a little deeper. I'll check the security footage. I'm hoping it reveals something useful. I still don't know if I want to go to the police. Maybe if it's someone I know, I can at least confront them before I'm forced to resort to that. Brad follows me into the office. I power on the computer and open the security app. I think Brad can feel my frustration because he doesn't speak while I search the footage for several minutes. There, Brad says, pointing to the lower left-hand corner of the screen. I slow down the footage until we see a figure. When I hit play, we both stare in confusion. Someone is curled up on the back steps, unmoving. We watch the screen for about half a minute until I hit rewind again. According to the timestamp on the footage, the person remains on the steps for over 2 hours, without a blanket, in a Boston October. They slept here? Brad says. They weren't too worried about getting caught, were they? I rewind the footage even more until it shows the person walking into the frame for the first time, a little after 1 a.m. Because it's dark, it's hard to make out facial features, but they seem young, more like a teenager than an adult. They snoop around for a few minutes, dig through the dumpster, check the lock on the back door, pull out the spray paint, and leave their clever message. Then they use the can of spray paint to attempt to break the windows, but Corrigan's windows are triple paned, so the person eventually gets bored or grows tired of trying to make a big enough hole to fit through like they did at Bibbs. That's when they proceed to lie down on the back steps where they fall asleep. Just before the sun rises, they wake up, look around, and then casually walk away like the entire night never happened. Do you recognize him? Brad asks. No. You? Nope. I pause the footage on what may be the clearest visual we can get of the person, but it's grainy. They're wearing jeans and a black hoodie with the hood pulled tight so that their hair isn't visible. There's no way we would be able to recognize whoever this is if we saw them in person. It isn't a clear enough picture, and they never look straight at the camera. The police wouldn't even find this footage useful. I send the file to my email anyway. Right when I hit send, a phone pings. I glance at mine, but it's Brad who received the text. Darren says Bibbs is fine. He pockets the phone and heads towards my office door. I'll start cleaning up. I wait for the file to finish sending to my email, then I start the footage over again, feeling more pity than irritation. It just reminds me of the cold nights I spent in that abandoned house before Lily offered me the shelter of her bedroom. I can practically feel the chill in my bones just thinking about it. I have no idea who this could be. It's unnerving that they wrote my name on the door, and even more unnerving that they felt comfortable enough to hang out and take a 2-hour nap. It's like they're daring me to confront them. My phone begins to vibrate on my desk. I reach for it, but it's a number I don't recognize. I normally don't answer those, but Lily is still in the back of my mind. She could be calling me from a work phone. God, I sound pathetic. I raise the phone to my ear. Hello? There's a sigh on the other end. A female. She sounds relieved that I answered. Atlas? I sigh too, but not from relief. I sigh because it isn't Lily's voice. I'm not sure whose it is, but anyone other than Lily is disappointing, apparently. I lean back in my office chair. Can I help you? It's me. I have no idea who me is. I think back to any exes that could be calling me, but none of them sound like this person. And none of them would assume I would know who they were if they simply said, it's me. Who's speaking? Me, she says again, emphasizing it like it'll make a difference. Sutton? Your mother? I immediately pull the phone away from my ear and look at the number again. This has to be some kind of prank. How would my mother get my phone number? Why would she want it? It's been years since she made it clear she never wanted to see me again. I say nothing. I have nothing to say. I stretch my spine and lean forward, waiting for her to spit out the reason she finally put forth the effort to contact me. She pauses. I can hear a television on in the background. It sounds like The Price is Right. I can almost picture her sitting on the couch, a beer in one hand and a cigarette in the other at 10 in the morning. She mostly worked nights when I was growing up, so she'd eat dinner and then stay up to watch The Price is Right before going to sleep. It was my least favorite time of day. What do you want? My voice is clipped. She makes a noise in the back of her throat, and even though it's been years, I can tell she's annoyed. I can tell in that one release of breath that she didn't want to call me. She's doing it because she has to. She's not reaching out to apologize. She's reaching out because she's desperate. You dying? I ask. It's the only thing that would prevent me from ending this call. Am I dying? She repeats my question with laughter as if I'm absurd and unreasonable and an asshole. No, I'm not dying. I'm perfectly fine. Do you need money? Who doesn't? Every ounce of anxiety she used to fill me with returns in just these few seconds on the phone with her. I immediately end the call. I have nothing to say to her. I block her number, regretful that I gave her as long as I did to speak. I should have ended the call as soon as she told me who she was. I lean forward over my desk and cradle my head in my hands. My stomach is churning from the unexpectedness of the last couple of minutes. I'm surprised by my reaction, honestly. I thought this might happen one day, but I imagined myself not caring. I assumed I'd feel as indifferent toward her returning to my life as I did when she forced me to leave hers. But back then, I was indifferent to a lot of things. Now I actually like my life. I'm proud of what I've accomplished. I have absolutely no desire to allow anyone from my past to come in and threaten that. I run my hands over my face, forcing down the last few minutes. Then I push back from my desk. I walk outside to help Brad with the repairs and do my best to move beyond this moment. It's hard, though. It's like my past is crashing into me from all directions, and I have absolutely no one to discuss this with. After a few minutes of both of us working in silence, I say to Brad, "You need to get Theo a phone. He's almost 13. Brad laughs. "You need to get a therapist who's closer to your age."
Chapter 6. Lily. "Have you decided what you're doing for Emerson's birthday?" Alisa asks. Alisa and Marshall threw a first birthday party for their daughter, Riley, that was so big it was worthy of a sweet 16. "I'm sure I'll just let her have a smash cake and give her a couple of presents. I don't have room for a big party." "We could do something at our place," Alisa offers. "Who would I invite? She'll be one. She has no friends. She can't even talk." Alisa rolls her eyes. "We don't throw kids' parties for our babies. We throw them to impress our friends." "You're my only friend, and I don't need to impress you." I hand Alisa an order from the printer. "Are we doing dinner tonight?" We get together for dinner at least twice a week at their place. Ryle occasionally pops by, but I purposefully plan my visits on nights he's on call. I don't know if Alisa has ever noticed. If she has, she probably doesn't blame me. She says it's painful watching Ryle when I'm around because she also suspects he still has hope for us. She prefers to spend time with him when I'm not present.
Marshall's parents are coming into town today, remember?
Oh, yeah. Good luck with that. Alisa likes Marshall's parents, but I don't think anyone truly looks forward to hosting their in-laws for an entire week. The front door chimes, and Alisa and I both look up at the same time. I doubt her world starts to spin like mine does, though. Atlas is walking toward us.
Is that?
Oh, God, I mutter under my breath.
Yes, he is a god, Alisa whispers.
What is he doing here? And why does he look like a god? It makes the decision I've been weighing that much more difficult. I can't even find my voice long enough to say hello to him. I just smile and wait for him to reach us. But the walk from the door to the front counter seems like it's expanded by a mile. He doesn't take his eyes off me as he makes his way over. When he reaches us, he finally acknowledges Alisa with a smile. Then he looks back at me as he sets a plastic bowl with a lid on the counter.
I brought you lunch,
he says casually, as if he brings me lunch every day and I should have been expecting it. Ah, that voice. I forgot how far it reaches. I grab the bowl, but I don't know what to say with Alisa hovering next to me, watching us interact. I glance at her and give her the look. She pretends not to notice, but when I don't stop staring at her, she eventually yields. Fine, I'll go flower the flowers. She walks away, giving us privacy. I turn my attention back to the lunch Atlas brought. Thank you. What is it?
Our weekend special, Atlas says. It's called Why Are You Avoiding Me Pasta?
I laugh. Then I cringe. I'm not avoid... I shake my head with a quick sigh, knowing I can't lie to him. I am avoiding you. I lean my elbows onto the counter and cover my face with my hands. I'm sorry. Atlas is quiet, so I eventually look up at him. He seems sincere when he says,
Do you want me to leave?
I shake my head, and as soon as I do, his eyes crinkle a little at the corners. It's barely a smile, but it causes a warmth to tumble down my chest. Yesterday morning, when I ran into him, I said so much. Now I'm too confused to speak. I don't know how I'm supposed to have a full-on conversation with him about everything that's been going through my mind over the last 24 hours when I feel so tongue-tied around him. He had the same impact on me when I was younger, but I was more naive back then. I didn't know how rare men like Atlas were, so I didn't know how lucky I was to have him in my life. I know now, which is why it terrifies me that I might screw this up, or that Ryle might screw this up. I lift the bowl of pasta he brought. It smells really good.
It is good. I made it.
I should laugh at that, or smile, but my reaction doesn't fit the conversation. I set the bowl aside. When I look at him again, he can see the war in my expression. He counters with a reassuring look. Not much is said between us, but the nonverbal cues we're trading are saying enough. My eyes are apologizing for my silence over the last 24 hours. He's silently telling me it's okay, and we're both wondering what comes next. Atlas slides his hand slowly across the counter, closer to mine. He lifts his index finger and skims it down the length of my pinky. It's the smallest, most tender move, but it makes my heart flip. He pulls his hand back and clenches his fist as if he might have felt the same thing I did. He clears his throat.
Can I call you tonight?
I'm about to nod when Alisa suddenly bursts through the door to the back, wide-eyed. She leans in and whispers, Ryle is almost here. My blood feels like it freezes in my veins. What? I don't say that so she'll repeat it. I say it because I'm shocked, but she repeats herself anyway. Ryle is pulling in. He just texted. She waves a hand toward Atlas. You have 10 seconds to hide him. I'm sure Atlas can see the absolute fear in my expression when I look at him, but he very calmly says,
Where do you want me?
I point to my office and rush him in that direction. Once we're in the office, I second-guess myself. He might come in here. I cover my mouth with a shaky hand while I think, and then point to my office supply closet. Can you hide in there? Atlas looks at the closet and then looks at me. He points at the door.
In the closet?
I hear the front door chime, and I'm filled with even more urgency. Please? I open the closet door. It isn't the most ideal place to hide an actual human, but it's a walk-in closet. He'll fit just fine. I can't even look him in the eye when he moves past me and into the closet. I could die right now. This is so mortifying. All I can do is murmur, "I'm so sorry," as I close the door. I do my best to compose myself. Elisa is chatting with Ryle when I exit my office. He greets me with a nod, but his attention is back on Elisa. She is digging through her purse for something. "They were in here earlier," she says. Ryle is tapping his fingers impatiently. "What are you looking for?" I ask her. "Keys. I accidentally brought them with me, and Marshall needs the SUV to get his parents from the airport." Ryle looks irritated.
"Are you sure you didn't set them aside when I told you I was coming to get them?"
I tilt my head, focusing on Elisa. "You knew he was coming?" How could she forget to tell me he was on his way here when Atlas showed up? She reddens a little. "I got sidetracked by unexpected events." She holds up her hand in victory. "Found them." She drops them in Ryle's palm. "Okay, bye. You can leave now." Ryle makes a move like he's about to go, but then he turns and sniffs the air.
"What smells so good?"
His and Elisa's eyes meet the bowl at the same time. Elisa pulls it to her, cradling it. "I cook lunch for me and Lily," she lies. Ryle raises an eyebrow.
"You cooked?"
He reaches for the bowl.
"I have to see this. What is it?"
Elisa hesitates before handing him the bowl. "Yeah, it's chicken barabadula meat." She looks at me and her eyes are wide. She is such a horrible liar.
"Chicken what?"
Ryle opens the bowl and inspects it.
"It looks like shrimp pasta."
Elisa clears her throat. "Yeah, I cooked the shrimp in chicken stock. That's why it's called chicken barabadula meat." Ryle puts the lid back on and looks at me with concern as he slides the bowl across the counter back to Elisa.
"I'd order pizza if I were you."
I force a laugh, but so does Elisa. Both of us laughing makes our reaction seem way too compulsory for a joke that wasn't even funny. Ryle's expression narrows. He takes a couple of steps back, a suspicious look in his eye. He must be used to the two of us having inside jokes that he isn't a part of, because he doesn't even question us. He spins and walks out of the flower shop in a rush to get the keys to Marshall. Elisa and I both stand as still as statues until we're sure he's left the building and is way out of earshot. Then I look at her incredulously. "Chicken barbo what? Did you just completely make up a new language?" "I had to say something," she says defensively. "You stood there like a lump. You're welcome." I wait a couple of minutes to make sure Ryle has had time to leave. I walk out front to ensure Ryle's car is gone. Then I regretfully walk into my office and head to the supply closet to inform Atlas he's in the clear. I exhale before opening the door. Atlas is waiting patiently, his arms crossed as he leans against a shelf, as if being hidden in a closet doesn't bother him in the least. "I'm so sorry." I don't know how many apologies it will take to make up for what I just asked Atlas to do, but I'm prepared to say it 1,000 more times.
"Is he gone?"
I nod, but rather than exit the closet, Atlas grabs my hand, pulls me in, and closes the door. Now we're both in the closet. The dark closet. But not so dark that I can't see the flicker in his eyes that indicates he's holding back a smile. Maybe he doesn't absolutely hate me for this. He releases my hand, but it's so cramped in here for the two of us, parts of him are grazing parts of me. My stomach knots, so I press my back into the shelf behind me in an attempt not to press into him, but it feels like he's draped over me like a warm blanket. He's so close, I can smell his shampoo. I very calmly try to breathe through my nerves.
Well, can I?
He asks, his voice a whisper. I have no idea what he's asking me, but I want to answer with a confident yes. Rather than blurt out my consent to a question I don't even know, I silently count to three. Then I say, can you what?
Call you tonight.
Oh. He jumped right back into the conversation we were having out front, as if Ryle never even interrupted us. I pull in my bottom lip and bite down on it. I want to say okay, because I want Atlas to call me, but I also want Atlas to know that me hiding him from Ryle inside of this closet is probably on par with how the rest of our interactions will go, since Ryle is always going to be in the picture, considering we share a child. Atlas, I say his name like something awful is about to follow it up, but he interrupts me.
Lily.
He says my name with a smile, like nothing I could possibly add to his name would be awful. My life is complicated. I don't intend for it to come out like a warning, but it does.
I want to help you uncomplicate it.
I'm scared your presence is going to complicate it even more. He raises an eyebrow.
I'll complicate your life or Ryle's life?
His complications become my complications. He's the father of my child. Atlas dips his head ever so slightly.
Exactly. He's her father. He's not your husband, so you shouldn't allow your concern for his feelings to persuade you to give up what could be the second best thing to ever happen to you.
He says that with such conviction, my heart feels like it's tumbling down my ribcage like a Plinko chip. The second best thing to ever happen to me? I wish his confidence in us were contagious. What's the first best thing to ever happen to me? He looks at me pointedly.
Emerson.
Hearing him call my daughter the best thing to ever happen to me makes me damn near melt. I hug myself and hold back my smile. You're going to make this difficult for me, huh? Atlas slowly shakes his head.
Difficult is the last thing I want to be for you, Lily.
He moves and the door begins to open, spilling light into the closet. He faces me with one hand on the door and the other on the wall.
When's a good time to call you tonight?
He seems so at ease with this conversation. It makes me want to pull him back into the closet and kiss him, so that maybe some of his assurance and patience will seep into me. My mouth feels like cotton when I say, whenever. His eyes settle on my lips for a beat, and I feel the look all the way to my toes. But then Atlas closes the door, shutting me alone inside the closet. I deserved that. A mixture of embarrassment, nervousness, and maybe even a little bit of desire is flooding my cheeks. I remain unmoving until I hear the faint chime of the front door being opened. I'm fanning myself when Elisa opens the closet door moments later. I quickly drop my hands to my hips to hide what Atlas's presence does to me. Elisa folds her arms across her chest. You hid him in the closet? My shoulders fall with my shame.
I know.
Lily. She sounds disappointed in me, but what would she rather I have done? Reintroduce them to one another? I mean, I'm glad you did it, because I'm not sure how that would have turned out, but you hid him in the closet. You just shoved him in here like an old coat. Her rehashing the moment isn't helping me recover from it. I move toward the front of the store with Elisa on my heels. I had no choice. Atlas is the one guy on this earth Ryle would never approve of me dating. I hate to break it to you, but there's only one guy on this earth Ryle would approve of you dating, and that's Ryle. I don't respond to that because I'm terrified that she's right. Wait, Elisa says. Are you and Atlas dating? No, but you just said he's the one guy Ryle would never approve of you dating. I said that because if Ryle had seen him here, that's what he would have assumed. Elisa folds her arms over the counter and looks crestfallen. I'm feeling very left out right now. There's a huge gap you need to fill in. Gap? What do you mean? I try to look busy by pulling a vase toward me and moving some of the flowers around. Elisa takes the vase from me. He brought you lunch. Why did he bring you lunch if the two of you aren't actively talking? And if you're actively talking, why didn't you tell me about it? I pull the vase back from her. We ran into each other yesterday. It was nothing. I haven't even spoken to him since before Emmy was born. Elisa grabs the vase again. I run into old friends every day. They don't bring me lunch. She slides the vase back to me. We're using it like a conch shell, as if we need it for permission to speak. Your friends probably aren't chefs. That's what chefs do. They cook people lunch. I slide the vase back to her, but she says nothing. She's concentrating so hard, it's like she's attempting to read my mind to get past all the lies she thinks I'm spewing. I pull the vase back from her. It's honestly nothing. Yet. You'll be the first to know if anything changes. She looks momentarily satisfied by that response, but there's a flicker of something in her face before she looks away. I can't tell if it's concern or sadness. I don't ask her because I know this is hard for her. I imagine the idea of any man bringing me lunch who isn't Ryle probably makes her a little sad. In Elisa's idea of a perfect world, she would have a brother who never hurt me, and I would still be her sister-in-law.